Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hi, I'm Matt Lieb.
And I'm Vince Mancini.
And this is
Pod Yourself a Gun,
a Sopranos podcast where me and Vince Mancini go through every single episode of The Sopranos
and talk about it.
Thank you so much once again for checking out our wonderful Sopranos podcast, the only Sopranos podcast in the world. Just a reminder, you know, 5 stars and a review. Obviously, that's my favorite thing for you to do. Check us out on OnlyFans. Obviously, that is we're going to be showing just pictures of naked gabagools. Mm-hmm. Little capicola slices all up on my balls. But also, I do want to remind people that we have a couple of social media handles. We have a Twitter account at Pod Yourself a Gun, and Instagram at Pod Yourself a Gun, and we don't have that many followers on it, so why don't you just do us a favor and follow those, and then you can get all your updates and shit. I think that would be, I don't know, important to you, maybe. Who knows? Or maybe you're not into it. It all depends on your use of social media. But go ahead and follow at Pod Yourself a Gun on all the social platforms. Also, the end of the episode, we are, of course, going to do our Pod Yourself a Shout Out. That's an $8 tier for Patreon supporters. You pay $8 and then Vince, stop doing the thing with your hand. he's like, hurry it up. Frogcast at Gmail. No, that's not it. Patreon.com/Frogcast. Now I'm nervous. $8 tier gets you a shout out at the end of the episode. Okay, I'm done, Vince.
Oh,
you happy?
Oh, are you? Whew. All right. Awake. I'm awake again.
Okay, good. I'm so glad. You know, you could always participate, but you don't have to. Today, Vince Mancini and I are going to be talking about Sopranos Season 5, Episode 7, In Camelot. And we have a wonderful guest today. This is a returning Pot Yourself a Gun champion. You know her, you love her from the Ethnically Ambiguous podcast. Ladies and gentlemen and everyone else, welcome Shireen Yunus.
Oh, hello. What a lovely introduction. I do think I'm a legendary guest because I said that Beansy was gay.
You did. You said Beansy and Richie probably had like a gay thing going on.
I will die on that hill. That is the subplot that is underneath. Anyway, thank you.
I think you're right.
I think we all agreed. And a lot of people were just bowled over by the accuracy of that insight, was I.
The funniest thing that happened after that was someone posted about it on Reddit. Someone was like, Pod Yourself a Gun guest says that says a fan theory that Richie might have been gay. And the responses were, "Ugh, not this again."
So it's been discussed.
It's been discussed, apparently, but I think that's what makes it all... It's like one of those things where I'm like, man, you know, fandom is weird because anything like that you think is unique about a show you're watching,
nothing I think is original. Everything I say is not original.
Well, because they spent all their time... Right, but they spent all their time thinking about The Sopranos, you know? And we have just been living our lives occasionally doing a Sopranos podcast. And we're chill. We're cool. We're having like good times and shit. You know, we're having sex. And then
you are, maybe, I don't know.
Okay, well, I'm having sex.
Speak for yourself.
Vince had sex at least once.
Yeah.
Oh, proof. Cool.
I got proof.
You got proof. And, you know, so we come up with these fan theories, and all the, like, true fans are like, we've been thought about that. So
yeah, they're like the hipsters of TV watching.
They really are.
We were here before you even existed or knew cool.
Exactly. Yeah. They've been cool, you know, way longer than we've been cool. So good for them. But
sure, you can have it.
You can have it. Fuck you. I'm sorry. Fuck you is a little harsh. If you're one of those people, please keep listening. We love the surprise.
Yeah, of, it's great.
Yeah. Speaking of which, Shireen, just a quick interview about the Sopranos. Do you like the Sopranos?
I love the Sopranos.
Sick. Yeah. That's tight. Us too.
Got that out of the way.
Questions?
Moving on.
Yeah. What if I was like, have you ever had a guest say no?
I think we have. I'm pretty sure, or not. No, I've had a
virgins and people that are new to it, but
oh, cute.
I don't think we've had any full on dislikers, which would be weird.
Okay.
Yeah.
No one full on disliking it, but like I have asked people, like, how big of a Sopranos fan are you? And there have been people who've been like, I don't know, medium. Like, what do you what do you want me to say? You know, which is fair. This does not have to be your favorite show. Do you have a favorite show, Shireen?
I'm obsessed with Nathan For You, and I could watch that over and over, and I would be happy.
Well, that's
and John that, Wilson, the one that came out, How To with John Wilson. I think those are my favorite type of shows, where it's just like
pranks.
I don't know. It's not even pranks. I just like it to. It's not even. No, it's not. I don't consider them pranks.
They're prank
think,
shows.
They're not prank shows. I don't like prank shows. John Wilson is not a prank show. Come on.
I don't know that one. I just assumed it was also
How
pranks.
To with John Wilson is like poetic art. I highly recommend it. It is okay. So beautiful. And it's like the cyclical. Every episode is like a cyclical thing. It starts with one.
Prank?
No, it's not a prank. It starts with one question. Like, where does
is your refrigerator still running?
Just, if you have any taste, you'd watch it.
I like it. It's good, but I like Matt's idea of it too.
Fair.
I mean, I'll check it out. For sure. But I mean, Nathan For You is like I think one of the all time funniest TV shows ever made.
Exactly. Yeah.
And it also gives me like the level I've become accustomed to awkward shit, like awkward situations and awkward humor, and so it's like I keep needing people to up the ante, and Nathan For You like filled that gap where I was just like, yeah, Borat's good, but you know,
maybe that's a hot take. I won't continue that, sorry.
Well, tell me your hot take. Why don't you like Borat?
Well, okay, I came to this conclusion like pretty firmly after I saw the second one, even though I mean, whatever, it doesn't matter. But in the first one, I felt like he was kind of, I mean, as an Arab, like a Middle Eastern person, it kind of is a little like strange to be a caricature of something that you're not a part of. But then the second one, it was around the same time that Bad Trip came out with Eric Andre, right?
Right.
And I was comparing the two, and Eric Andre, like, the vibe of that movie was just, like, joyous and fun, and he, he made people feel good, and at the end, there was a blooper reel where they, like, they told them, that like, the truth, and they were all happy or whatever.
Right.
And then Borat, on the other hand, like, he literally put his whole crew was at risk. So many of them got COVID. They went to a Republican convention, like, without any, like, in quotes, protection, but, like, it was a weird time. I just think it's, like, I don't know. I just got a bad vibe from that movie compared to whatever. It's like exploitative is my word. Yeah.
Okay. So it's like the prank shows that you like are I
when
agree
the audience
with you.
Is endearing. Like it's not like it's not like they're poking fun and humiliating them constantly.
Right. Well, I mean, you know,
we'll have to have a separate
I
podcast about that because I have thoughts. But
are you a huge, I mean, like, people are such big fans of it, you know?
I don't know. I mean, I don't, like, disagree with the criticisms, but, yeah. But you know what? He doesn't ever go and hang out outside a pork store, so therefore I don't care about it that much, you know? Like, it's sort of
that's
fades
a good point.
Into the background.
I don't care about it that much either, but that just proves that I'm not a fan of all pranks, and I don't think Nathan For You or John Wilson are pranksters.
Well, now I'm convinced that the hot take was born out of my saying that you just like prank shows.
You'll never know.
I'll never know. But we don't need to know about this because this is not a prank show slash movie podcast. No, this is a Sopranos podcast. And of course, we cannot start the podcast without first playing the theme song. Pod. 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 Podcast. Pod. Pod. Pod.
Podcast.
Today we are talking about From Season 5 of The Sopranos, Episode 7, In Camelot, which premiered on April 18th, 2004. Vince, break us off a little piece of that synopsis.
Tony learns about his father through the man's mistress, while Chris's friend learns that there are habits more harmful to your health than heroin.
Okay. Yeah, strong synopsis. Vince, what was happening at the time that this episode came out?
Oh, that's right, Matt. You know, we can't evaluate any art without knowing the context released. And for that, we go to the Remember When machine.
Is there a sound effect? Walk,
heard walk, daddy, daddy, bop, bop, shoo, bop, remember
then. Remember when is the lowest form of conversation.
That's right. We're taking the Remember When machine all the way back to April 18th, 2004. Mm-hmm. You know, it was a different time than we're living in now. Just so many things.
That's so true, dude.
Changed, but so many things stay the same. And, you know, just to properly put you in the mindset of what was going on at the time, this is from the New York Post. This is actually about an article in the New York Times, but it's a nice.
Nice.
Cliff's
We're
notes.
Getting meta with the Wayback Machine.
Yeah. Hill We're pens getting- new RX for healthcare. A decade after her healthcare initiative went down in flames, Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton has again placed herself squarely in the middle of a debate, penning a lengthy magazine article on the future of what she calls a seriously flawed system.
Oh, damn, dude. Thank God, you know, she's right about that. Clinton's- I wonder if she'll continue being right about that in the future.
Clinton's cover page opus is the main story of the New York Times Magazine's annual medicine issue. Its cover line, "Now are we ready to talk about healthcare?" She opens the piece by joking, "I know what you're thinking. Hillary Clinton and healthcare. Been there. Didn't do that." But the former first lady's humor doesn't...
I know what you're thinking when with Hillary Clinton talking is like, that could be a number of things.
Right. Yeah. I know what you're thinking. I failed you.
I know what you're thinking. I killed Vince Foster with my bare hands. Yeah. But this isn't about that.
But the former first lady's humor doesn't last long. Asserting that the healthcare system has declined even further since she proposed giving Americans universal coverage in 1994, she makes some new proposals and repeats old ones, including healthcare for all children and all who are in poverty.
Oh, wait, hold on. Back up. How is that new from universal healthcare? Everyone...
it's a backslide. She's like, well, that didn't work, but what if we did Obamacare instead, basically?
Yeah, right, I mean... Right. I love that it's like, okay, well, so you guys didn't like it in 1994 when I proposed universal healthcare. What if I just completely watered that down and said a handful of people can have it? That's
and then people want, and then it's children. She's baiting you. Like, don't you want to protect children?
Yeah which absolutely. Yeah. And you know, everyone else too. But
but
children are cute.
It didn't age well.
Yeah.
This is from the Random File, also from the Post. Ticket video shock. Agents did ignore victim. I felt like this was relevant to The Sopranos for some reason. Maybe you'll
I'm very excited about this. I don't know what any of those words mean.
A surveillance video showing an elderly Brooklyn tailor having a fatal heart attack after getting a $115 parking ticket clearly shows NYPD agents blithely ignoring the victim, his family's lawyer claimed yesterday.
Oh, fuck.
City officials claim 61-year-old Sicilian immigrant Onofrio Avinti was loading groceries into his double-parked SUV when he collapsed in Bensonhurst April 10th. They said the agent who ticketed Avinti outside a Met food market was unaware of the man's plight when the agent drove away with a partner. But lawyer Sanford Rubenstein showed reporters his cleaned-up copy of the video, which shows Avinti, apparently in agony, stumbling into the street directly in front of the agent's car.
Damn.
What?
City Hall lied to the public and lied to the press, said Rubenstein. Clearly, Mr. Avinti was not putting groceries into the trunk. The heart attack began right in front of the agent's car, and Mr. Avinti was blocking it. Avinti's family is suing the city for $100 million.
Jesus Christ.
I need to know what happened. Like,
he got a $115 ticket and then had a heart attack in front of the car. And then apparently,
no,
like,
I
the
mean,
cops,
if he got money out of it. I want to know.
I could not find a follow up.
And I was very sad about it. I assume they settled because otherwise we would probably know about it.
I mean, it's just, it's like, on the one hand, I'm kind of like, you know, I get it, you know. He's Sicilian. He's being dramatic. You know, he's just doing his, like, oh, why do you do this to me?
Take me now, God.
Yeah.
$115. Who got that kind of money?
But on the other hand, I'm like,
how am I going to afford gabagool for my kids?
But on the other hand, you know, it just goes to show that.
Very sad to the
family. Yeah, RIP.
Oh,
wait, he died?
Yeah, he died of a heart attack. That's
yeah,
gotta
fatal
be.
Heart attack. Yeah, he died.
Yeah, it was fatal.
Oh my God. I thought he just like got, he, the help came in. Wow. And you guys laughed at him.
Well, wow. No, I mean,
we laughed at my comical
fun
Italian
of a dead
accent.
Man. You're making fun of a dead man.
No,
Maybe it was just a prank.
It was just a prank. Oh, we're just doing pranks.
But that person should be like, at least, like, some murder should be associated with their name. They didn't help a dying person. They just walked away.
Yeah.
That feels very NYPD. They are truly.
They're like, oh, not my problem.
Like, oh shit, this is gonna be so much paperwork. Speed around.
Exactly.
Him.
And was it a meter maid? That's probably the worst thing ever.
They kept calling it an agent.
They said NYPD traffic agent.
Yeah, that's a meter maid in one of those like little electric carts.
Wow.
Oh God. Well,
I mean,
they
I don't know in 2004 if it was electric, but yeah.
They said car, yeah, uh-huh. But yeah, they don't say what kind. Could have been one of those little carts.
I like to believe it was a little cart, and he just kind of like slowly sped away at 15 miles per hour going full speed.
Yeah, that is unfortunately hilarious.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Oh, man. Well, that is so that was what a time.
What a time to be alive. The top movies in the country, Kill Bill Volume 2 had just come out, number one at the box office. The Punisher, that's the one with Thomas Jane.
Tom Jane, dude.
I think they made two other Punishers, I want to say. Johnson, Family Vacation, Hellboy, and Home on the Range.
Mm.
Top pop song is still Yeah by Usher and Lil Jon.
Oh, God.
And top rock song is still Figured You Out by Nickelback.
Jesus
All
Christ.
All I needed to hear were the top songs, and I'm brought back immediately.
Like, yeah, you know exactly where you are.
It's a dark time.
Yeah.
It was a dark time. It was a scary time in the world. But in the Sopranos universe, it was also dark and scary because, you know, they're in the mafia. So that's what was going on. And now let's get into this episode. Like Vince said, you know, this the quick synopsis of this episode is, you know, Tony meets his dad's Kumar. And, you know, Chris has a friend in recovery who he preys on because that's what Chris does. So all of that is well and good, but as you all know, I have my own version of the synopsis. And this is a synopsis based on the fact that we first meet JT Dolan, a addict and TV writer who is really trying to get this job working on Law and Order.
Yeah.
So, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to present to you the Bada B story.
Uh-oh.
Bada B story. Sopranos 507.
Baka Bako.
This one's got JT. He writes for TV shows. Yeah, fucking Tony meets Fran Feldstein. She slept with his dad and he helps to get her some money, chasing down Philly Atardo. Junior's going a little stir crazy. Yeah, he keeps going to different funerals, but now he's starting to cry at those. Hey, and Chrissy prays on his rehab friend. His name is JT. He pawns his Emmy. Fucking LA Matt. Flap, flap, flap.
Yeah, there it is.
Did you play the guitar for that one?
No, that was one. I'm almost never doing live instruments.
Think about it.
Wow. I didn't think. I mean, this is a compliment. I don't think it's going to be very hard for you to top the Calling by Your Name remix that you did.
I know.
But that was pretty fucking, but the Law and Order one is pretty good too.
I mean, yeah, that was the thing. This one, I was just like, who's got the time? You know, I was thinking about like all the songs I could do. And I was like, what if I just did this one in like 10 minutes, you know?
I mean, they name dropped Dick Wolf like 3 times. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. I had no choice but to do the Law and Order theme with lyrics. But anyways, let's talk about this episode and all of the, you know, subplots in it, all the Bada B stories that are going on. Just general thoughts first. Vince, what'd you think about this episode?
I mean, I think this is another fantastic episode this season. I feel like, they're really stringing like amazing episodes back to back. This one's like another one that is, it has an arc, but it's also very like thematically tight. I mean, the whole thing is about just like how we choose to remember things in a way that like, you know, flatters ourselves and doesn't really adhere to the facts necessarily. Like,
totally.
We're remembering things in such a way that, it flatters our own ego. And like the whole episode is about that. And you see like separate echoes of it with each character. And, I don't necessarily think that thematically tight equals a good episode, but it was just sort of hitting on all cylinders in this one, I think.
Yeah, this was meaty. As soon as I started watching it and realized that JT was introduced in this one, I was like, oh fuck yeah, this douchebag.
Yeah.
Yeah.
JT,
when he was stroking his own ego, this line was so funny to me. He says, I had the Beamer and the actress girlfriend, drugs, alcohol. That stuff practically comes with the Writers Guild card.
Yeah. So JT to me is such a monumentally funny character to write for The Sopranos, because like it holds like a special place in my heart, because at this point in my life I've known a large handful of TV writers.
Yeah.
And the way that the Sopranos chose to shit on TV and TV writing in this episode was like, mwah, chef's kiss, fucking brilliant.
And also, and also recovery, and also like Hollywood memoirs. Like they managed to like hit them all just in like a few lines of JT.
Oh, yeah. It's so fucking great to make this guy like a recovering addict / TV writer, and have him basically emulate, I don't know, like every TV writer. Not every TV writer I've ever known. A few of them are cool.
We know a lot of JTs. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We know so many JTs who cannot go a fucking single sentence without doing a name drop, without like mentioning a job that they're on.
It's the worst.
A job that they're getting, a job that they had, like just the constant name dropping of work, and also like constantly kind of like, you know what he reminds me of? He's every comedian.
What if he named an actual comedian just now? That would be really funny to me.
I'm not gonna, but I was. It's every comedian on Twitter who the way they announce something cool is either going, hey, I made a thing, and then it's like this huge, like, yeah, they have a TV show, and you're like, yeah, that's not a thing, that's, I made a TV show.
Yeah.
And then or
it's like, oh,
or,
I'm being humble, but like, no, you're really not.
Yeah, yeah, I made a thing is the fucking most humble, braggy, yeah, shit for Hollywood people. It
something
drives
that I think
me crazy.
It's more subtle, but like on Instagram stories, they'll be like their, yeah, laptop in front of them, being like, "Today's office, like I'm writing is this writing shit's easy." I'm just like, I hate it. But
I hate it, and it's like I will admit, like, a lot of this does come from like a place of like resentment for me. Like, there's definitely like,
oh, for sure,
I look at it, I, like, in total honesty, it is, you know, it starts out with resentment, but then when you get to know enough people who like work in Hollywood, like, you start, there are cool people, there are people who do not constantly brag, they like, they you know, there's people we know who just talk about real life shit, but then there's JTs, and it, yes, and like the cool TV writers or the cool Hollywood people just make the JTs just like pop more,
yeah,
you know,
exactly.
And and I love that the Sopranos decided to do a whole episode where they were just like, we hate writers.
Well, that's the thing. I'm a sucker for like self-deprecating humor.
Yes.
And the scene where, can I like jump around to the episode, or is it like,
oh, please, go ahead.
That when he tries to pawn his Emmy, and the guy is like, if it was an Oscar, an Academy Award, maybe I could give you something for it. But what, yeah, is this? He doesn't even recognize what it is. I thought that was so funny.
Yeah.
He never gets any respect for being a TV writer, yeah, which is like, you can tell is like the one thing that in Hollywood, he would get total respect.
Yeah.
Anywhere else in the world, they don't give a shit. And
exactly,
I have a clip of that scene.
Oh, please.
It's a fucking Emmy. It's gold-plated.
Melt it down, man. Look, I told you $15.
Oh, fuck, man, come on. This is, like, huge, this shit.
If you had an Oscar, maybe I could give you something. An Academy Award. But TV. What else you got?
I don't know. I got a laptop. My car.
Yeah, okay. Cool. I'll check that out.
That is, like, hands down, one of the funniest jokes in the entire series, in my opinion.
It is.
Like,
yeah,
it is so god tier. I love it.
And
it's
Tim Daly,
the writers just writing the conversations that they have at Thanksgiving with their family and friends.
Yes, yes, it is. That. It's like the feeling of their life is important and their work is important, and people not knowing what they do or not really caring. And just, I love this is like huge, this shit.
Yeah, he, yeah, can't elaborate or explain why it's a big deal. He just
huge
has to be like, dude, come on, like, obviously, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And I fucking like,
it's the same thing that Tim Robinson does on I Think You Should Leave, where he,
yes,
always writes like these inarticulate characters who are explaining why something's a huge deal, but they never have any follow-up. It's just like,
yeah,
you know. I,
yeah,
mean,
yeah,
that show is hilarious.
You guys, yeah, right, it's so good every time.
So
too
good. So good.
It's,
yeah,
so funny. And like, you gotta like, props to Tim Daly for, mm-hmm, really making this character come to life. It is,
yeah,
so good.
He has the look for that really, like,
he really
perfectly
does.
Which is weird, because like, you'd think an actor would be too good looking to play a writer, but it fits like our idea of what a writer, TV writer would look like, really.
Well, because
perfectly,
I think because I don't know, I mean, not whatever, but he's like a good looking white guy, right?
Yes.
And like, he
100%.
He probably like got in the room pretty easily, you know what I,
yes,
mean,
yeah,
but he's,
yes,
just, yeah, yeah, he's the golden child of TV, right? The image that you think of, which is fucked up when you think about it.
Did you ever,
right, yeah,
did you see,
you think of any scripted narrative drama and you're like, it's fucking seven Tim Daly's, it's seven,
yeah,
JT Dolans,
yeah,
and, uh-huh, then, you know, like three maybe women, or like, oh, two women and a black guy,
yeah, a brunette.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, diversity.
Yeah, and they're like, oh, we got a diverse staff. It's all Tim Daly's.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. And that's just how it's been in Hollywood since the beginning.
The
you know,
dawn
and
of
it's
time. Yeah,
yeah, since the beginning of Hollywood. And it's just kind of like funny to see. I don't know. It's cathartic to watch him lose. It's one of like, yeah, the most cathartic episodes for me. And again, fueled by resentment, maybe, but like, yeah. For me, it's mostly just like, Chrissy is in this position where he is both, you know, he's in recovery and, he's hanging out with this guy who he both, hates and resents for his, like, actually making it in Hollywood. 'Cause Chris tried to make it and mm-hmm. failed in Hollywood. Mm-hmm.
But he also fucked him over.
Even when Christopher is like admitting that he fell off the wagon, his admission is, I had some wine and was like, yeah. Bro, you chug like half a handle of vodka and then shot up your boss's car. You didn't just have some wine.
Yeah, and also beat your fiance who had just been in a car accident. Yeah.
Yeah.
But his
excuse was my fiance was in a car accident and I was so emotional. That's right, like a fucked up lie. That is a really fucked up lie.
So Chrissy, it starts out with Chrissy is in a meeting in an AA meeting with JT, who's doing his share, and Chris is rolling his eyes at kind of like his constant name dropping and kind of like his ego shining through during a share.
Best of all, I had all the flake I needed to keep me churning out that snappy dialogue for Corbin Burnson. Practically comes with a writer's guild card. Anyway, it got so bad that I blew a deadline on a Nash Bridges.
But then at one point, JT like name drops him and goes, Chrissy, where are you at? And then he said, this is my friend Chrissy, and he does like a fist, like he likes being friends with the Hollywood guy and hates the shit out of
it's
him at the exact same time.
Love yeah. your relationship. And there's a little bit more hate in this, in his actions in yes. this episode.
Yeah.
But and, he puts him in like shitty situations and he's like, why are you in this shitty situation?
But I feel I think Christopher thinks he's being like a good friend for most of this episode.
I think so too.
Like,
I don't think so.
I feel like he thought, oh yeah, this guy like drove me to it basically. Like, yeah. I mean,
he's a learning lesson.
Yeah.
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 But in that scene where Tim Daly's doing his share, it's kind of like he's doing the very stereotypical Hollywood. It's the stereotypical Hollywood memoir at the same time as this stereotypical AA share where you're very much mythologizing how cool you were like before you fell off the wagon. Like they they have to make their bottom seem more dramatic by being like, oh man, I was on top of the world.
Right.
Like people do the same thing at church where it's like, oh yeah, I was like the most famous art dealer in America until my wife almost ran over this black homeless guy and decided to adopt him or whatever the
what a turn.
Hey, you know, church, it's like that.
What was that one movie about where the guy was
The Blind Side?
No, it's almost like The Blind Side, but like it's like the guy's wife decided to befriend like this guy at the soup kitchen and then
we saw that one
Hansu.
Yeah, Digimon's in that.
Yeah.
Same it's
kind
like,
of different as me. That's it.
Yeah, same kind of different as me. It's a Christian movie. But yeah, I mean,
but it's the same general arc where you make yourself seem really cool at the beginning of the story.
Yeah, because like AA shares when people are kind of like doing them and it's not the same, I think, across the board. You know, some people focus entirely on recovery. And they do like a quick share of their background. It's kind of like a lot of the times it's like the point of sharing is kind of to relate to everybody else. Like you'll find something in everyone's share that is relatable to you as an addict. Because like all the stories are kind of the same. It's like we all kind of like we all deteriorate in the same way. The illness is progressive and you progressively fucking, you know, lose all the shit that you had.
Right.
That is a normal share. I think with JT, you've got like his ego, because he doesn't have a story that is like, you know, fucking his bottom isn't insane. You know, he wasn't like selling his ass, right? His bottom is like, you know, I found heroin and then I missed a Nash Bridges deadline.
Right.
And then I didn't work for a while.
I was getting unemployment, but it wasn't enough. Yeah.
Yeah. And that, right. Exactly. It was just like, because he's in this position of privilege and he doesn't have like his bottom being like this incredibly cool, like incredibly like crazy story, it needs to be a cool story. Mm-hmm. And so he's name dropping the entire time.
I was doing enough flake to keep pumping out that snappy dialogue that Corbin Burnson loves. That's the stereotypical Hollywood memoir thing where they can never just say cocaine. They have to give it like a cool name.
It's
like,
oh, yeah, it's a cool guy name.
I called it cool names. I was with the cool kids.
And they presented me with this magical white powder. And I was like, exactly. What is this?
Yeah.
It's like they can't actually ever step away from their privilege. Even in AA meetings, they're like, mm-hmm. I'm still better than you.
Yeah, and that really shines through in everything that JT is doing. So afterwards, Chris and JT go to a diner, and JT spends like a good amount of time just kind of bragging about stuff. And before he asks Chris what's up with him, and I just have a clip of that.
My new agent. Next week he's got me set up to meet Dick Wolf's guy.
I seen Dick Wolf at Rayo's one night. Guy's got his own limo.
Got Law and Order money? I could have his own battleship. But, enough of my shit. How are you doing?
Good. You know, working the program.
Yeah, hella good, dude. Shit's going great for me. So thank you for asking after bragging about your fucking possible job.
Yeah.
It's this constant, like, just constant bragging about his life and all the cool shit he's doing. And you can see that Chris is, he's feeling low. It's almost like there are certain toxic relationships that exist. I think this is true outside of the program, mm-hmm. where if you've ever been friends with a braggart, you'll know the feeling of them constantly talking about cool shit they're gonna do or, you know, are doing or whatnot, and you leave the conversation feeling worse about yourself, right. and it's like I used to think like this was a totally just a me problem. I'm like, man, I'm like, really, I've got too much resentment because every time I talk to this person, they just, you know, they mention something cool they're doing and I just feel bad about myself. And then I realized it's like, no, this is a toxic thing we have going on, because if you reverse it, the same thing happens to them, and there's just like, I think it's kind of a universal thing.
If JT, I mean, what JT was telling him is so normal in LA, like everyone does that, kind of like, not everyone, like, and like stupid people do that to just like hype themselves up, being like, oh my god, mm-hmm. I have an interview for XYZ or whatever. But in the context of like sitting in a New Jersey diner with Chris, it seems stupid. And I think Chris recognizes this, like, like an imbalance of what he perceives like power, and I think he like reclaims it with his actions later on. You know what I mean? So
There's also a very good moment of scene setting in there that I wanted to point out, where like the first shot of Christopher is he's like checking out the girl next to him's tits out of the corner of his eye, and then, and then he snaps back into focus of JT's share, and that was just such a great, it was like a split second, but it was such a perfect shot to set that whole scene.
Perfect. Yeah, I mean, setting Chris up as someone who's staring at tits while this guy is sharing, and then listening to his share, and then rolling his eyes at him, and then later, like, giving him a fist bump, like, yeah, I'm your friend. Like, that is, it's perfect fucking,
comical.
Like,
it's
comical, and it's exposition without any fucking dialogue from him. He doesn't need to say anything. You know exactly what this relationship is.
Yeah.
And so Chris admits that he relapsed, and JT kind of gives him a hard time about it, and, you know, is like, oh, why don't you call your sponsor or call me? And then he runs out of there because he's like, you know, he's like got a date or something. And Chris is convinced that he is going to fucking cop. He's like, mm-hmm. he's positive that this guy's going to go get high, and he's just not saying anything. So he confronts him at the gym. And JT says, no, this is not at all fucking about me getting high. I went to go gamble at the racetrack. And that's when I feel like this is unintentional on Chris's part, but he lights up a little bit. he's just like, hey, if you want, I can take your action.
I can capitalize on this.
Yeah.
But see, again, I don't necessarily think that that is a conscious thing. It's kind of like,
I don't think so.
Where they're talking about it with Tony and Artie like a few episodes back. It's almost just like reptilian brain where they just like slip into like, well, yeah, I could wet my beak on that. And it's not
true. I don't think it's a conscious, like, it's not as calculated as it might seem, you know. I think it's just second nature to be like, oh, I could organize, like, I do this thing and you can come in and see, try your luck, but also I'm not gonna play favorites.
I think you're totally right. There's like a level of like personal responsibility that like mobsters believe in, where they're like, you know, because it's not just fucking people like JT, like degenerates who are gambling. Their friends are gambling, other mobsters are gambling, you know, and you know, for him it's like, yeah, you know, go ahead and gamble. I'm happy to take your action. The idea that you would get busted out is like, that's on you. Even though they are the ones doing it, you know, like charging them a hella interest, making them pay VIG, like they're like, whoa, this is not on me, you know?
Yeah. Well, I almost think like, I think Chris was seeing, like, giving him his own responsibility. Like, Chris left, he's like, I'm gonna go, I'll see you in the morning at the gym, whatever. Like, I think he fully expected him kind of to be at, like, to show up, you know?
Totally. And I think so,
like,
so too.
He's proven wrong and he realizes that, like, JT just traded in an addiction for another one. And
right.
It's too far gone at that point.
And there's this great moment in the bar when, after JT wins, like, a sports bet, where he is saying, you know, I never really got into, I don't know, like, games of card before, or whatever the fuck you called
chance,
it.
Yeah.
Games of chance, but there's something about, you know, this that's so, I don't know what. And then it's like, is addictive? Yeah, is addictive, duh. Bro? Is that what you're trying to say? Like, it's so clear.
I was going
to
say, I think Tim Daly, he's so great as this character in that, like, you 100% can never tell if he's being earnest or if he's full of shit.
Yeah.
Like he always, every single line could be a lie in this
even
show.
Even when he was telling Kim I was at the racetrack, I didn't believe him, even though I knew, like, I know what's going to happen. Like, everything he says is so transparently not honest.
Yeah. Right. It's just, it's all ego based too, because he was just like, I just got a $3,000 residual on a That's Life episode.
Yeah. It's like, I mean, his whole identity is tied to pompousness. And like,
to being a TV writer and being a big shot Hollywood guy.
Yeah.
That's funny that like, I didn't remember That's Life, so I had to like look it up, but apparently
it's a real show
that was on CBS. From 2000 to 2002. So it's only like 2 years removed from when the show was on. And it's like another like sort of mob adjacent show that's set in like Newark and in New Jersey. So they're really like taking shots at the competition with this one.
I know. It was straight up it was a diss track.
Wow. That's hilarious now that I think about it. Like, because like if you dig deep, it's like, oh, this white guy is talking kind of about a version of Chris's life.
And he says that Guinea Fest with Paul Sorvino, that was totally unrealistic.
The hour-long series follows the life of a young Italian-American woman loosely based on Diane Ruggiero and her family in suburban New Jersey. The show is set in fictional Belfield, ostensibly a play on the combination of Belleville and Bloomfield. In the first season, Frank DeLuca works as a toll collector on the New Jersey Turnpike, while Dolly is a housewife.
It sounds like a CBS sitcom.
Kevin Dillon played Polly, Lydia's younger brother, who was a young officer on the Belfield Police Department who still lived at home. Oh, yes. Yeah, so they got Kevin Dillon and Debbie Mazur. So, you know, this is a real like trial run for Entourage.
But also, I think like The Sopranos was already on for a while at that point, right? I feel like they were like, oh, Italians are doing well. Let's like make
that's
an Italian
totally
show.
Right.
100%.
And I feel like the writers of the show knew that.
Yeah.
So they're like, just like, I don't know.
They probably tried to poach some of the actors at some point.
Yeah. They totally did. So biting our stuff. Like, I bet Paul Sorvino was like in talks to do like something on there.
Yeah.
And they were like, sorry, I got to do That's Life.
But, gotta go make that network money from CBS. And they're like, oh, hey.
I mean, it's really funny how many name drops there are. Like,
he constantly
does it. I didn't
know
that That's Life was even real. And I love that. Like, there's also this really funny part before Chris or JT gets beaten up by Chris and this whatever that guy's name is.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's Lil like, Pauly. What is this, Pulp Fiction?
Yes.
And that's his only frame of reference for people fighting. Like,
yeah.
Only-
yeah. That's so good. They're like, no, dude, this is real life, stupid. And they're like, yeah. Oh, shit. So, oh, that's also another great line where he's like, what can you do to me that I haven't already been through? And it's like,
oh, it's so it's like, good.
We know what? That's a line you say in AA, but.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's one of the greatest scenes in this episode. But before we get there, so JT shows up to the executive game and right. fucking, you know, is playing cards and whatnot. And he's losing to Vito. And he's also losing to the car wash king, who I don't know who he is. But he has a moment where he asks him about TV writing, but nobody gives a shit.
Cowboys and Three Little Indians.
Fuck me.
So when you write on TV, what do you have, like one guy writes the words for Dylan McDermott and one guy writes for Nicholson's girlfriend? Is that the way it is?
You write it all yourself.
Oh, interesting.
It is the curse of being a writer in any yeah. capacity, is that like when someone asks you what you do for a living and then you're not quick enough to think of a lie, and then you say writer, and then like there's always 10 follow-up questions and like the answers are always way longer than they are interesting, and like you know right. that going in, and you like it feels like you're being mean to the person, but really you just want to save them the boredom of the ensuing yeah. conversation because you've right, been there before. Yeah.
And also yeah. like he's not used to, like, I'm sure he is fielding questions about being a TV writer like when he's in LA in Hollywood, and like, you know, some
people don't
young
bat an eye, you know what I mean?
Right. Well, like, yeah. some young hungry writer, maybe, you know, like he would love to take under his wing and tell him how right, the biz works, right. but they're starting from such like a place of total ignorance of how TV works that they're like, so does do different people write different lines for different characters?
I just love that, like, it's like 2 seconds or less after he like loses so much money and he's like, they ask him this question. It's just so funny to me. It's like, oh fuck, it's like, so TV writing, this thing that you pretend to do. Yeah,
yeah. And then he's just also like, huh, interesting. Yeah. No, it's not
both,
it's not interesting.
They're
to anybody
both being condescending in their own way, really.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
Well, they also, I like that Christopher also bait and switched him, where he's like, yeah, I got a high stakes game for you. David, I can't say the names of the famous people that play in there, but, you know, David Lee Roth. And then he shows yeah. up and it's like the car wash king of New Jersey.
It's, like, yeah. it's the car wash king and fucking Vito.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you can hear Tony in the background at one point. He goes like, we got some really big players coming tomorrow, or something mm-hmm. like that, where it's like clear that he's going to kind of like the off season of the executive game for that night.
Yeah.
So Chris comes back to the executive game and finds that JT is still there losing like fucking crazy. And it's clear that, you know, he's a fucking gambling addict. And mm-hmm. JT,
the most
like,
telegraphed plot line of all time, and it still works.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it is crazy because it's like, this is a plot line that's been done before on this. Like, we've already had Davey Scavino in
right.
It's like either season one or season two, who gets busted out. Because he's like fucking, he's a homie of a gangster and decides to fucking, like, you know, be a degenerate gambler and lose all of his fucking money at mm-hmm. cards. But for this particular character, it's so much more funny because of the fact that he is so confident
yeah.
that he is going to be fine, because he's like got that Hollywood type of confidence where it's like, nah, man, you know, easy come, easy go, but don't worry, like, I'm about to get this huge job, so yeah. you think, well, I could borrow money for child support?
Because I mean, like, it's, he's always the main character of his story, right? So it's yes. gonna have to work out for him. And like,
yeah, he is the protagonist of yeah. every fucking story in yes. his mind.
And
yeah,
I don't know. It's, I think just like the Pulp Fiction line later, he mm-hmm. he hasn't experienced any kind of real life. Like, he's like, yeah. oh, I've gambled. Yeah, I'm going to do great at this. Or like, yeah, I've done XYZ. But like, now he's in the real world of people that like do this all
yes.
the time. And
yes,
it's pathetic.
Summertime and the living is thirsty. At least it is in the Lieb household. And when we are trying to get hydrated, we reach for the best water on Earth, Fiji water.
Fiji water is bottled at the source and untouched by man until you unscrew the cap. Fiji water really is from the islands of Fiji, 1,600 miles from the nearest continent, and it is sourced from an ancient artesian aquifer and is naturally preserved from external elements.
That's right, Vince. You can literally taste the difference. So whenever we do an ad, we sometimes get samples sent to us of whatever we're advertising. And when I first got sent Fiji water bottles in the mail, I thought it was hilarious. I was like, I've tasted water before. Why would they do this? But believe me when I say, this is absolutely the best water I've ever tasted. And that's because Fiji water is a natural artesian water with 100% natural electrolytes. Unlike some other top premium bottled water brands, Fiji water's electrolytes are 100% naturally occurring.
That's right, Matt. Fiji water has more than double the electrolytes as the other two top premium bottled water brands, giving it its signature smooth, soft taste. Fiji water is the number one premium imported bottled water brand in the US, and it has a perfectly balanced 7.7 pH.
Also, Fiji water's 330 milliliter and 500 milliliter bottles are made from using 100% recycled plastic. Fiji water continues to lead the top premium bottled water competition on launching 100% recycled plastic bottles. The aquifer Fiji water originates from is a sustainable source and will continue to replenish as the rain and water cycle persists in the islands of Fiji.
So get stocked up on Fiji water this summer and visit your local retailer to pick some up today for your next backyard party, beach or pool day, hike, or even your home office. It's not just water.
It's Fiji water.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Synovus.com.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Synovus.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Yeah, and so he borrows some money from Chris, who gives him the money that he owes the room, and he also gives him some money for incidentals, like, mm-hmm. you know, child support or whatnot. Yeah. And then he finds out he's, like, charging him VIG, and Chris has this great line.
Don't give me that look. This is your problem. I will not fucking enable you.
Yeah,
I mean, his but he version has a of point.
I mean, he
that
does have
him
a point.
Being helpful. He's like trying to be a good friend. I really think so.
He is. Yeah,
in a way, he is.
He is. But it's also like his idea of not enabling someone is to charge them VIG. I love that.
Right.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. 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 It's almost like he's. it's almost like a dad being like, I'm giving you this responsibility. This is a learning lesson.
Right, exactly. This is him making his son smoke the whole pack, you know?
It's also great that, like, as dumb as Christopher is, he can immediately, like, calculate the interest on, like, a $60,000 loan and, like, what the installments are going to be.
I was like, that was pretty hot.
I was like, I need to go back and get a calculator to make sure this is all right because I can't.
It's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
But you see a little bit of, like, Chris's, I mean, maybe I'm reading into it, but I think at this point, his eyes are a little, like, he lights up a little bit when he figures out, like, that this guy has been there all fucking, like, 2 days. And, like, there's part of me that it's that swing in the balance of power is happening where Chris is kind of realizing, like, you know, he's not going to let his friend off the hook here because he's not really his friend.
Yeah.
And
he's thinking this guy bothers this. He annoys me so much. And I think he was genuinely surprised to see him there. And I do agree. There was like a flicker in his eyes. And suddenly he was like, oh, I have the upper hand now.
Yes.
I'm gonna keep it here.
Yeah. And he fucking, like, you know, cause like he is, when he's at that bar and JT wins, like, he's feeling low again because he's relapsed again. And this guy is fucking just once again beating Chris at this game of recovery, you know, in life. Yeah. It's like this guy is clean. He's working out all the time. He's got all this TV shit going on and he just won a bet. And now his luck is starting to turn. And like a fucking seesaw, Chris is feeling a little bit better. So Chris goes over to his house where Chris threatens his recovery friend for the money. And I have a clip of that.
I was away. I went to AC.
Where's my money?
I don't have it yet.
But you went to AC.
I have a meeting next week with Rene Bolsey. Dick Wolf's right-hand guy. He likes my stuff. He told my agent I'm going to be on staff.
I got out of that business because people fuck you over. John Favreau? Faggot cocksucker tried to steal my ideas.
I swear on all that's holy, I'll have your money next week.
That wasn't the deal. I'll be back tomorrow. Don't make me a jerk off.
The next morning.
JT, by the way. This is fucking Pulp Fiction. Am I supposed to be afraid?
I don't know. I didn't see it.
You're really being a prick, huh? I told you, I need more time. I don't have the money.
Then fucking get it.
Chris, you know me. What could you possibly do to me that I haven't already been through?
I'm positive we'll think of something.
Oh, God.
Yeah, but I think that's like part of the reason that The Sopranos is such a good show is that, you know, they don't make Christopher like a total bad guy. Like, he did give this guy three or four opportunities to change his behavior, and the guy the guy sort of pushed him to it, but then Christopher is also like inherently predatory. Like, the whole the whole mafia thing basically consists of figuring out ways to make money off of your friends, and so he's just doing that. Like, what do you expect him to do?
And it's the first, you know, like it's interesting because this is the first time I feel like JT has ever encountered a person like Chris, like an actual mafioso, and this is the first time he hasn't been able to like charm his way out of a situation. Right. So he's just kind of like, man, you're really being a prick, huh?
Right. And it's like, my usual tricks aren't working.
Yeah exactly. The fact that Lil Pauly is like, I don't know, I never seen it like that.
There's like a perfect like parallel there. Like JT is his only frame of reference for violence is this Tarantino movie.
Yes.
And on the other hand, the person that like maybe that violence is like semi based off of has never seen it. So it's like, it's almost like saying like Hollywood is made for people that live in a fantasy land. You know what I mean?
Yes.
They've never even experienced anything.
Try moving to the suburbs with like a creative industry job. And then like you try to like when you try to explain what you do to other people whose jobs are like, oh, I'm a lawyer, or I fucking install drywall, or like whatever. Like, you can't say your own job without feeling like an idiot.
Right. Yeah.
And just like JT is, I think, starting to realize, especially after he gets beat up, that like this is the first sociopath he's ever met. And like this is what a real sociopath is like, and nothing like exemplifies that moment more than when after he tries to hawk his Emmy, Chris comes over to check in on him because he hears that he's been hit in the vein, and Chris is trying to, you know, be like, man, you were doing so good and you fucked it all up, and he's like, you know, why didn't you just call me?
Where do you get the right?
And JT has this look on his face like, is this guy is fucking insane.
Yeah.
Yeah. This guy literally doesn't understand why I wouldn't call him, the guy who just beat the shit out of me.
Well, he just like Chris, I think in a way he genuinely means it because he's just able.
He does.
He's able to compartmentalize these parts of his life, right? Because like he considers JT a friend, and like that look that JT gives him is so funny. He does it again in the car later, and it's just the funniest like. Are you shitting me?
You're
kind of why I'm here.
Yeah, Chris genuinely doesn't understand why other people don't look at him as the like five compartmentalized personalities that he is. It's like, obviously I didn't mean for you to call me like the VIG collecting Chris. I wanted you to call the sponsor Chris, which are obviously two different people, and everyone can see that.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. There's a level of like these guys living their compartmentalized identities in ways that they're so normalized to them that they just don't understand. Like,
they don't understand.
You call rehab me. I'm the good me.
I also think that like JT is a little naive in thinking like this guy's my friend. He wouldn't do this to me. And in Chris's world, you basically kill your friends. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, it's not.
Well, what isn't JT naive about? Like, he's the guy who's like, I don't know why as an addict I'm finding gambling so appealing all of a sudden. It's like, really, bro? I mean, like, what did you learn in AA?
Yeah,
that's the thing. To me, he is the perfect example of somebody who got clean in rehab and got his, like, recovery in rehab. And all of it was kind of based on kind of like external fucking pleasing people on an external level. He's in rehab because he wants his jobs back. You know, he's getting clean and sober because he wants to, you know, get back to be the person that he was before all of this. He's not doing it in order to like have
to be a better person or something.
To be a better person or beyond that, to like make up for all the terrible shit that he's done. He's not doing it to he's got no spirituality at all. He's like, that for him this is a means to an end, and so I feel like he is it's funny at in that first scene after he brags about fucking everything that he's ever done, he goes, today I want to talk about taking a moral inventory, which is to me that moral inventory is the name of this episode, the alternate title. Like, taking a moral inventory is basically when you're listing all of your character defects and all of the good things about you, all the bad things about you, all the people you hurt and whatnot. It's like, it's part of the program. And this is an episode for the viewer where you are taking JT's moral inventory the whole time. You are seeing all of his defects of character before he's even seeing it. And it's just wonderful. It ends with him fucking having to pawn, having to sell his car.
I love this car. Everything.
But like Chris spends this whole episode like just saying, thinking that recovery is saying a bunch of platitudes.
Yeah.
And like there's at one point where what is it? He's in his office and he finds out about, you know, the fact that JT is using again. And there's a sign right next to Chrissy's face that just says, "Expect miracles." And it's a small moment, but I love it because like you see those signs and like you see a lot of this like recovery talk throughout, like, you know, different meeting spaces. Sometimes you go to a meeting, someone's house, and it's like this guy is surrounding himself with the literature and the platitudes of AA, but not really internalizing it. And it ends with him telling him right before he drops him off and steals his car, there's no chemical solution to a spiritual problem. And then he drives away.
I love that line coming out of his mouth because I think both of them treat recovery like a diet. You know what I mean? Like,
I
ate too much. Like, how could you not follow through? Like, come on, girl. Like, whatever. And it's just like, to them, it's like, a diet. Like, they go on and off, and that's yes. what I think it is. But
they remind me of, like, kind of like Success Win Bros on Instagram. You know, like hashtagging keep grinding, taking a picture of themselves at the gym. You know, this is all for the external world. It's not at all for the internal, you know?
Exactly.
And it's just wonderful. I mean, it's just, more JT, I say.
Yeah.
More. But great let's character. Move on.
Please.
Well, we also got Junior Soprano Funeral Crasher to talk about.
Yeah, so Junior Soprano's storyline in this episode is it's a bit thin, but it is kind of you're kind of this is the continuing journey of his mental health ups and downs. Mm-hmm. Like, he is finally you know, his memory is recovered, he's feeling a bit better. His uptake inhibitors, as Bobby called them, are working. Mm-hmm. And so he is using funerals as an excuse to, you know, get out of house arrest. And
he's talking about the food at a kid's funeral.
Yeah, this is just an episode where Junior is just being inappropriate at funerals.
Yeah. Which I think would have been, like, I think that part of it would have been B story, like on a lot of shows. Mm-hmm. But Sopranos being the Sopranos, like, they don't let you have the happy ending ever, even in the middle of the episode. Like, by the end of the episode, they just have Junior completely crashing and
he broke. It's
internalizing, like, the morbid nature of the funerals, and, like, recognizing that he doesn't have the family like all these people do.
Well, because when he's, like, when he's commenting about the spicy chicken or whatever at this kid's funeral, you look at that and you're like, wow, this guy has no empathy. And then it's just like this, it's piled up until he actually breaks and he's like, I can't do this anymore.
He got reverse irony poisoning. He got, like, earnestness poisoning from being at too many funerals.
Yeah.
I mean, he's got, there's just so many great moments of him at funerals. Number one, he calls Awake an after party.
That
was so good.
That was great.
But it's like, if you go to, like, Italian or, like, I assume Jewish funerals a similar way, it's like, like, it is basically like an after party. Like, you can't grieve without having, like, a giant spread of food for whatever reason. I feel like people would, like, people commenting on the food at, like, an Italian funeral seems pretty normal.
I mean, it's
but
definitely
not after the mother is crying into someone's arms.
Sure.
Like, there's like timing, you know?
Oh, exactly. Yeah. But
A kid dies, and Junior is looking for any excuse to get out. And so he hears from Bobby that this kid drowned in a jacuzzi. Mm-hmm. And he calls up Mel, his lawyer, and he says, I got another funeral. It's a kid. His father does my shirts.
Yeah.
And it's like, he's like, they have to be related to you. And he's like, come on.
Yeah.
So he's able to go to that funeral, and he's just like, the chicken's nice and spicy. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he does finally break down at the other guy's funeral. This is Kajet's
Uncle Zio.
Uncle Zio. So his her husband is now dead too. Junior has a hilarious breakdown that I think is just...
I thought it was really sad. You're a monster.
I thought it was funny.
Bless us, thou woman, and bless us, the fruit of thy womb.
Oh, this fucking shit. What's the point?
Uncle Jim.
I can't take it anymore.
Hey, you need to lower your voice, come.
This is something about that scene just, like, got me. I think
just the idea of them being like, oh man, he's crying too hard at a funeral, we gotta take him out of here.
I mean, he's just embarrassed. His entire storyline is him being embarrassing at funerals. And that's just a fantastic storyline. That's just, I just love that so much. And then he goes to the doctor, and the doctor's like, you know, we'll try to, like, fix the medication.
What did you do?
I don't know. They after me. But yeah, that's basically Junior's storyline. And it intersects with Fran's storyline, which we're about to get into, in that Junior is secretly in love with Johnny Boy Sopranos, his brother's Gumar. Mm-hmm. And we meet for the first time, Fran Feldstein at a funeral. Oh, before that, I'm sorry. We have to talk about Tony's family dog.
Well, that's also part of it, though.
Yeah.
That's also, yeah.
Yeah.
Tippy the dog.
Yeah. So Tony is over at Janice's and kind of doing his thing where he's like trying to say nice things, but he's still talking shit to Janice. He says like, the kids seem to like you, sort of.
Yeah.
Which,
yeah.
You know, that's as close as Tony's going to get to a compliment.
And then Janice's line is, I just let them do whatever they want all the time, because how else are they going to learn? And you're like, yeah.
Which is, I'm to connect that to JT, that's exactly what Chris did with JT. But yeah, so they're sitting around watching Beethoven, which is a movie about a dog. Yeah. And they ask for, you know, they ask Janice, can we please get a dog? And I have a clip of that.
Can we get a dog, please? I'll walk him, and I'll pick up the poo and pee.
Pee? Right. Start with your underwear.
We're a dog, remember?
I mean, just clowning your stepkid.
That one kind of, like, triggered me, because I used to, like, I wet the bed when I was younger because I had really bad anxiety. And so I felt for that kid in that moment. I was like,
I mean,
just such a perfect comment on what a shitty stepmom she is.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really funny. Because after it was right after they were like, you're great at this. That's just, just makes fun of me.
He got worms, though. Had to move to the country.
Tippy was gassed, Tony. Daddy took him to the pound. He used to drag his ass on the carpet just to scratch himself.
Gassed?
And he's so cynical about everything else.
Father told me he took him to live on a farm.
That's what they always say. That same farm must have 17 billion dogs on it.
You forgot that you cut off the line, dog shit up to the rafters, which is like one of my favorite lines. Like, he's got to paint a picture of the fictional farm. Like, they don't do a lot of like meta editorializing in The Sopranos, but when Janice is like, and he's so cynical about everything else, it works really well.
It does work. Yeah.
This is the first glimpse in this episode of just how much a baby Tony is, and like how much of a real, like a child, there's certain aspects of his life are, you know?
Right.
Like it's sprinkled throughout the whole thing, but.
Yeah, because he's idealizing his childhood in this way, where like for him, you know, like he's not going to believe that his father had lied to him about, you know, Tippy. It's like, no, he moved to the country. And just like, he just.
As
he
dogs
really,
do.
Yeah, as though
it's often
do.
How weird that sounds.
No, nor like how obvious that is. That's like, well, that's what they always say, as Bobby said, you know. But it's because he really idealizes his childhood, and he idealizes his father, who would never lie to him, even though, you know, we see later that his father lies a lot. So they go to Aunt Gadget's funeral, Tony goes to visit his father's grave. His mother's there too, but he's very specifically going there to visit his father's grave.
He's like covering his one eye so he doesn't see the mother's part of the grave.
Right,
I'm not here for you.
And that's when we meet for the first time Fran Feldstein, who is, you know, the girl from the fur department at Bamberger's.
Another question here. Like as with JT, basically everything that Fran says, like, you could choose to interpret it as earnest or not. And then, like, so just by the end, like, you realize she's kind of, you know, like a sad alcoholic who is kind of manipulative with people in her life. But I guess, like, the bigger question is, like, they sort of leave it ambiguous as to whether she manipulated this entire situation or whether she genuinely was just happened to be there at the Soprano funeral on a funeral day, or a Soprano gravesite on funeral day.
I think she's just doing what she's always done. She's always lived her life in this way, and she's gotten money this, like, kind of doing similar things, you know what I mean, just like being charming or whatever. I don't think it's that calculated, or maybe it is. Like, I don't think the percentage of calculation versus just like what she's always done is kind of, you know what I mean? I don't know.
Right.
Yeah.
I know. I agree with you for most of it, but then, like, it sort of raises the question. She doesn't necessarily seem like the type of person who is going to the grave of her ex-boyfriend. Like, it seems a little out of character for her, maybe.
Huh.
Hard to tell. It's hard to tell whether or not she like planned it out, knew that this funeral was happening, and like.
But how would she know that Tony would go up there?
Yeah, to me,
there's one of his family members is having like a funeral somewhere else in the same cemetery.
It could be assumed, but in this case, I gave it the benefit of the doubt. Her delivery of the line when she like sits next to Tony and says, you know, your father always said, if I ever needed anything, I could always count on you. And he's like, what do you need? And she turns and goes, absolutely nothing. Like, I think in general, I believed that. Tony kind of like goes out of his way to find a reason to help her because of the fact that she displayed such kindness in like going to, you know, visit this grave, something he thinks his mother would never do and something his mother probably never did.
Yeah. Which makes me question the motive because I'm kind of with Uncle Junior on this where Tony's like, hey, why don't we go visit my father's gravestone? And he's like, what, I'm going to talk to a chunk of marble? Fuck that. I'm going to the after party, which strikes me as more realistic. I never understood the thing in movies where people are like going to gravestones and like talking to them.
Well,
I don't know.
I think it's just like Tony's sentimental side. And I also think like the minute he sees her and realizes who she is, there's a connection he feels to his dad, right? And I feel like in his head, he was proud and happy that like this woman was so obsessed with his dad that she's like here years later. But I also think it made him think like, wow, I'm going to have so many women at my grave one day.
Well, he's living in the romanticized past. Like he wants to be connected to like the heyday of the mafia. Yeah. And like they bring up JFK, which is like, you know, probably like the high water mark of like the mafia being involved in politics and sort of important to world events. So he's kind of like living in this. I mean, his entire identity is built on this, like recapturing this idealized past.
Right.
And then he meets his father's mistress, and like any like lifelong single person, like you always think their life is way cooler than it actually is, and it turns out she's kind
of
just like an alcoholic with a lot of whatever.
A lot of debt.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just like with JT, it's all a facade.
It is. But things slowly start to fall apart with him and Fran throughout the episode. First, Tony finds out that what actually happened to Tippy, and it's just so much worse than him being gassed.
He gets genuinely so mad. As a grown-ass man. That's so funny to me.
Such a good reveal, too.
Yeah.
I have a clip of that.
No. The dog.
Oh, Freckles. He was a gift from your dad.
What? When? Oh, this is my fucking dog. Excuse me, I'm sorry. This was my dog. His name was Tippy.
Bruce loved him. I mean, he had him for almost 10 years till he moved to Tel Aviv. Then I had to put him to sleep.
The way she says that. So
The ending.
I mean, it is kind of so like... good. You know, if you find out your father had this mistress, it's almost worse to find out that your dog that you thought died just had this whole other secret family.
Well, I think it's hilarious
and a different name.
Like when he sees the picture of her son, what did he think for a brief moment? Is this my half brother? But instead, he's like focused on the dog. Like that, so
yeah,
intensely.
That's actually what I was thinking. The same thing. I was like, he seems to have been ignoring the kind of like physiological similarities between him and the kid and completely focusing
on why his dad would give him a dog
and like part of me is like, wait, is this his bastard half brother? And
I feel like that's this classic Sopranos just like defying natural sitcom or television expectations.
Yes.
Because like in any other show it'd be like about a half brother and they're like, nope, it's entirely about the dog.
Named Tippy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which in a way is like, can you imagine if your dad growing up just gave away the dog and he was living with some other family for half your childhood? It's so good.
Yeah, it is like kind of fucked up, but like I wouldn't throw a tantrum, I don't think.
Oh,
like, I
would.
Yeah, no, but Vince, you love dogs especially weirdly. You know, like that's your own thing. I think if it were me, I would be like a little bit put off.
If your parents gave away your dog, you wouldn't like feel completely betrayed.
I think I would be more pissed off, not about the fact that it was given away, because I'm already over that. That happened as a kid. I'd be more pissed off, and I think this is where, you know, Tony is at. He's more pissed off that, like, the dad gave it away to someone else who he was kind of starting a little family with.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Almost like he had
Well, that's
he
a
had
completely
a
different story
family.
Than, like, the dog went to go live on a farm. Like,
True,
of course. But I
but
also,
I think
you know.
It's also, like, the first indication that, like, oh, my dad lied to me. He's not perfect, you know? Like,
yes.
He's not this hero I thought he was. And you see later on just how wrong he was in other ways. But
and also,
I just think
like,
the first glimpse into that, you know?
He put, yeah, and also he put Tony on equal footing with, like, some other random kid that also in his life. Like,
I think that's his half brother. I'm just saying I
really do think it's his half brother, and I think Tony is just so egotistical that he can't even consider anything but his dog in that photo.
Yes. So moving on with this story, so Fran Feldstein kind of mentions offhandedly this racetrack that his father Johnny Boy owned.
But is
and
it offhandedly? Now that Vince
that's
is like
the question.
Making her
is
more it calculated, I'm looking at it differently now because I didn't analyze it that way.
It's well, possible that she did it more like kind of more calculated.
Right.
But
I mean, like the whole episode is sort of seeing like. Slowly turning on this character and being like, oh, maybe she's not as nice.
Right.
I mean, even Hesh, when I forget what Hesh says about her, but he's like, yeah, I never
is
liked
it
that
just
woman.
Something,
well, he also said she's a little pale for my taste, so it's not like.
Yeah.
Well, it's because he's like. He's,
I understand, but what, yeah.
It's just the casual dropping.
That
of,
was his biggest problem with
I only date black women.
Every
great.
Time he did a scene. Every time.
I also like that she calls Hesh a whore master. Not sure what that is.
That's a great word. Yeah.
But it is like, I imagine it meant like pimp. Like,
yeah,
he was,
like someone that just like had, yeah, exactly.
Well,
but
I've heard the word whoremonger before, but whore master is
whore master
better.
It's
like
is
nice really good.
Malapropos. Whore master is a cool nickname for like a porn star. Anyways, if I ever like quit podcasting and want to go full porn, I'm going to be Matt Whore Master Leap, just letting you guys know.
Oh, okay, cool.
So she tells him about this racetrack, should have been her retirement, and he takes it upon himself to be the guy who's going to get that money. Talks to Hesh, talks to Philly Leotardo, and you know, Philly does not want to pay, you know, this person. Neither does Hesh. Hesh is, I should give it to some trollop, which is fantastic. But Philly, like, really takes offense to the idea that somehow, you know, he owes 40 grand.
Yeah.
And there's this wonderful scene where Philly just runs away from Tony.
Yeah. And, a car chase and Rock the Casbah's play.
Oh, yeah. It's like, Philly,
Phil,
don't
Phil,
like it.
Phil casually tosses out his ice cream out the window. I watched that part 3 times. It was so funny to me. Yeah. Like, it was just like, boop.
He's like, oh, I'm in a car chase. I got to throw away this snow cone.
Yes. Yeah. But he gets his ass kicked. And, you know, it just, I love watching Tony throw his weight around, especially, you know, with New York, because those guys truly don't respect him.
Yeah.
You know, I'm thinking about it now. And this scene is very reminiscent of, you know, they brought up Pulp Fiction in the episode. Remember, there's like a car crash scene with like a lot of horrified bystanders in Pulp Fiction where one guy is like chasing after the other. And it kind of occurred to me that it's like a very similar scene, and that might have been like a
self-conscious
reference.
He even goes up to him and says, "Hey, mister, are you okay?" Which is like kind of the I didn't even realize
you are
that.
A film guy.
Just occurred to me like 2 seconds ago because I was thinking, you know, I really like scenes where there's horrified bystanders at a car crash, and that's not what the scene is about. And I was trying to think, where else have I seen that, and why do I like it? And I was like, oh, it's very obviously like a Pulp Fiction thing.
That's so true.
Yeah, look at that. Your brain firing on all cylinders.
Yeah.
Two things similar. One thing similar to other thing seen on TV.
I write down in blog. Anyways, so Tony is able to get the money. There's this great moment.
That car has a dent in it. Sorry.
Anyways, so Tony gets Fran the money, and there's this great moment where it's clear that, like, Fran is just spent all of the money on shoes instead of like turning on her phone and all that stuff. And you can see like Tony is souring on her because she keeps kind of dunking on Livia. Like, and he hates his mom. He hates his own mother.
It, like the more he dislikes her, the more he hates what she says. You know what
I mean? Right. And also I think it's one thing if he himself dunks on his own mother. Mm-hmm. It's another thing entirely of the gumar of her husband to also like say she dressed like a refugee and she was a handsome woman. You know,
you can make
like
fun of your own mom, but someone else doing it, it's a different
story. Sure, even Tony, if his mistress was demolishing Carmella, he wouldn't take it either. Like only I can.
Yeah.
There's a great description of his mistress, by the way, where she asked Tony to describe his women, and he says, she's Latin, but you know, from Spain.
From Spain.
to make sure Spain. That she knows it's all right, because, you know, not that kind of Latin. Like, calm down.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And she's not from Spain. Isn't she, like, Puerto Rican? She's, like, half Puerto Rican or some shit.
I have no idea.
Like, he's lying about her ethnicity to her.
I mean, he lies about everything. He lies about Fran at the very end, too. But, like, I think in that moment, he's like, she's classy, like you, like, educator, cultured, or whatever he says. And I think, like, again, he's, like, identifying with his dad, being like, oh, we're exactly the same. Look at
us. I do love that. She's classy. You know, she fucked JFK. Because that's what he did.
There's no higher mark of class for a mistress than saying, like, oh yeah, she was also having sex with the president.
Exaggerated to the extent that, like, it was 3 years, he would fly her to DC, and literally it was one fucking time.
Yeah, exactly.
By the way, that song playing during that scene is like one of the worst songs I've ever heard.
This episode, I've already said, has the funniest moment, I think, in all of The Sopranos. Mm-hmm. But I also think it has the most uncomfortable... I've never been more uncomfortable than when Fran is singing and coming closer and closer to the camera. Like, I was uncomfortable. I was, like, nauseated. It was just this emotion that I hated to feel, and I hated watching that.
I hated it back then. They played that so well. It was so creepy.
It is the most creepy thing I think I've seen on The Sopranos. I've seen people die.
This episode is the funniest moment and also the creepiest moment.
And I have a clip of that.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, Mr. President. Happy birthday.
Is that Sixth Sense?
Jesus Christ.
Is that Sixth Sense?
No, that was just me trying to redo Sixth Sense. It was just me trying to cry in Spanish, but I only know a few words. So I just kept going, no me gusta, señor.
I kind of thought it was you, but I was like, that's not possible.
And I was doing the Sixth Sense guy crying, ghost, Spanish ghost crying, saying, I don't want to die.
Yeah, I remember that.
Wow.
But I was saying the other song, when Tony is mythologizing Fran in the strip club.
The very end, the last scene.
Apparently it's a Linkin Park song.
Is it in the end? By Linkin Park?
Called Session, I guess.
Session.
Like, it like physically repulsed me to have that song.
It was just doing too much. It was like it felt very much like all right, we need a cool guy song for the end of this episode. You know,
where it's just like the pit, like the rock bottom of the aughts. I think that was America's bottom.
Yeah. Beyond that song sucking, though, that final scene where at this point he is well creeped out by Fran Feldstein. Yeah. Mm-hmm. He is like, you know, he's starting to reassess everything. His scenes with Melfi, you know, he's sort of starting to forgive his mother and then kind of like backslides a little bit, like, fuck her. But at this point, he's back to just kind of idolizing, you know, the past and, you know, saying all the shit about Fran, like, she was a real knockout in a day. She used to fuck JFK.
They said Kennedy used to go to the burrito shop and get a breakfast burrito and put his dick in the burrito didn't come back to the White House smelling like Fran Feldstein.
This is, what is that?
The dirt.
Fucking, yeah. This is the dirt. Tommy
Lee. I think the moment when Tony, you go back into his memory, and his younger self has so much hair, but two, I think, like, for once you see, like, when Tony has to back up his dad for, like, an obvious lie that, like, my mom could have died from bleeding or whatever. Like, right. I think Tony genuinely feels guilty about hating his mom, kind of. You know what
yeah,
I mean?
I think the arc of Tony in this episode is, like, he goes from unconsciously like creating these false memories to the end in that scene in the strip club. He's like very conscious of like creating the fake memory like deliberately because it's just safer for him to think that Fran is like this cool classy broad and not that she's kind of like a sad alcoholic user.
Well, also because he cares about his dad's image, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Like,
my dad was amazing. Like, this proves it even further kind of thing, you know? Yeah. Like, yeah.
I mean, image is all they have. And, you know, their whole point of living is so that when they die, everyone will lie to themselves about their lives, too.
Right.
Like, that
well, I mean,
is like...
That's, I mean, the whole... Like, almost every character in the show, they constantly get... They get right up to the point of, like, reckoning with their own decisions and how they see the world. And they realize that they can't take that next step because it will, like, make their lives a nightmare and it'll invalidate. Right. Yeah. Like, all, like, they realize that all of these stories that they've built up are, you know, defenses for them, and then they like they jump right back into it. They're like, oh, of course. Yeah.
Like a safe space.
Yeah, it's like when
I mean they can't, it's a house of cards.
Yeah, it's like when Meadow is in that, when she is at first she's like calling Tony out for being in the mafia and telling the cousins like how Jackie Jr. died, and then she realizes like she can't do that because like that's the, she's already in that life, so she has to continue the lie and
actually it was an Asian gang. But real quick, favorite, least favorite, any moments that we missed, you guys?
Well, we already talked about the least favorite moment.
The
creepiest moment of all time. And I think my favorite moment was the Emmy scene.
Vince?
I really liked that moment with Bobby saying shit up to the rafters for some reason. Because it's like he's describing his fanciful visual of something that he's imagined in his mind.
Sure, sure.
And then for least favorite, I have two. Which one we didn't talk about? We didn't talk about the extended flashback to like Livia and Johnny. Right. For some reason, it's just lit terribly, and then the acting is awful. Really weird flashback sequence, and then the song at the strip club was just makes me want to blow my brains out for some reason. But
One moment that we missed that I think is just one of my favorite things is just this quick cut where Tony is fucking Valentina. He's just staring at the poster with the Weimaraners on it.
Yeah.
And you could tell he's like struggling to like stay focused and he can't come because he's just thinking about Tippy.
She's also fucking yelling, show Valentina how much you love her, which is the weirdest.
No, that alone, I wouldn't be able to come. That's right. that someone yelling, you know, show me how much you love me.
And then Fran was also saying that, like, you have to make your man feel powerful, and Livia never did that kind of thing. And
right.
So I think like that's before he has sex with Valentina, and I think
it's in his head for sure. Yeah. I mean, he's got a lot of like mixed emotions going on. He's like thinking about, you know, there's like morality of this and blah blah blah. He is mostly just staring at a dog and he can't come, and I love it. I think I would say the real gangster. What would you say the real gangster is, Vince?
I think the real gangster is your self-protective ego.
Oh, all right. Fair. Yeah,
your own idealized memory.
I think the real gangster is fucking Chris Moltisanti. Because he really just shows up. He really shows up to do some gangster shit, and I fucking appreciate it immensely. Yeah, so if I had to rate this episode, I would say B+. Vince, what would you give this episode?
Oh, tough. I mean, I think it's one of the better ones that's out there. One of the best episodes ever, really. So definitely a solid B+.
Yeah.
Why? How is... Is that a bit that you guys do?
It's not a bit.
But Shireen, if you had to give this episode a rating,
I would say A-.
So we'll call it B+ if we're, you know.
Yeah, we got to round balanced. Down. A
we
got
to round down. That's
is
how it is.
Every episode of B+, is that what you're
that is. We've changed a lot. All right. Anyways, yeah, but I got to say, this is a solid A+ episode of Pod Yourself a Gun. Shireen, thank you so much for coming on.
Ah, thank you for having me. This was okay. This was fun.
Where can people find you on the internet?
I'm on Twitter at ShiroHero666 and on Instagram is just ShiroHero.
All right. So check those out and listen to Ethnically Ambiguous. It is a great podcast. If you want to, you will enjoy it.
Thanks, man.
Patreon.com/Frogcast for all the bonus episodes of the Frogcast, which is just Pod Yourself a Gun, but about movies instead and kind of not as in depth. The $8 tier is the Pod Yourself a Shout Out tier. And this week, we technically only have one new Pod Yourself a Shout Out patron, although we're going to be doing two. Because last week we missed a last name on a shout out and fucked everything up.
Oh yeah.
So the redo for last week is Lewis Purvis.
Oh man, I can't believe that's a good last name for a nickname.
Yeah, I get why he messaged us and said, "Hey,
we're calling him Booger because he's a big perv, you know, like the guy from Revenge of the Nerds."
Oh, okay, got it.
That's... Yeah, I get that reference.
Sure. And the second is Michael Reynolds.
Oh, Michael Reynolds. That's Kramer, obviously. You know, isn't that Kramer's name?
No, you're thinking of Michael Richards.
Yeah, it's close enough. We're calling him Kramer.
Well, you can't just. All right, fine. Fuck
what,
it. Michael
Kramer's
Reynolds.
Not a good nickname? We'll call him Cosmo.
All right, we're going to call. We'll call him Cosmo. So thank you, Cosmo and Booger. For you know, for your $8 contribution, and you can do it yourself and get your name shouted out at patreon.com/frogcast. Frogcast@gmail.com for all your questions, comments, concerns. Vince, what is the Google Voice number?
415-275-0030.
All right, everybody. Thanks again so much for listening, and until next time, don't stop believing.
Bitch, my name is fucking LA Man. Blah, blah, blah.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.